got a welcome to the panel on RNZ National. With us today, Jenny Giblin, founder of Giblin Group, which raises funds and does economic development work across regional New Zealand, and Chris Orr, Access and Awareness Advisor for Blind Low Vision NZ. To this first, a large blast in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, has killed at least 70 people and injured more than 3,700 others, the health minister says. Officials are blaming highly explosive material stored in a warehouse for 6 years. President Michel Aoun tweeted that it was unacceptable that 2,750 tonnes of ammonium nitrate was stored unsafely, the BBC reports. Hospitals are said to be overwhelmed and many buildings have been destroyed. I spoke with resident Michael Mana, who lives just out of Beirut. So you live 10 kilometres away and you felt it?
Yeah, we felt the earthquake. The building started shaking for around 5 seconds. Then after that, immediately heard a big explosion. I thought that happened really in the next building. It was very loud and big. Then I ran with my wife to the closet and hide there until we know what happened exactly. Lines were offline. We couldn't call anyone to know what happened. Then after the 3 minutes, we received a notification about us. And as you know, it was in Beirut Port.
So this just gives an indication of how massive this blast was, 10 kilometres away, and you felt it, the whole building shook. So what happened next? What else did you find out after that event?
Yeah, most of the buildings around us lost their window glasses. Lots of people were injured due to that earthquake and that explosion. And as you watched on the news in Beirut, it's like, you know, it's currently in a dark mode. Almost 4,000 injured people and more than 73 are dead. Till now, they are still searching for lots of missing people.
So what's happening now, Michael? Are there emergency messages coming through via the media? What's happening now?
Yes, currently they are still searching for missing people and the hospitals are full in Beirut. Usually they are going into mountains to find a place to do an operation or... I know that they are going into mountains to do some operations because they can't find a place in the city. The hospitals are full. And now they are saying in the media that they are receiving some help from Qatar and Iraq. Tomorrow morning at 2 p.m., they will receive a mobilized hospital, like 400 beds, I guess.
Gosh. So meanwhile, everyone in your building is safe and well, yes?
In the town and then the building, they are safe. But if you go near Beirut, like 4 kilometres away, you can find the damage there.
All right. Well, Michael Mana, thank you very much for your time and all the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Wallace. I appreciate it. Bye.
And I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more across the evening about that. Explosion in Beirut. 4:10, the labour force unemployment data was released today. Unemployment dropped to 4% in the June quarter. Official labour force data from StatsNZ shows. It's been described as a bit of a shock release, with economists having picked a wider range of latest previews, even up to 6.4%. Meanwhile, figures from the development agency ATEED show 150 Auckland businesses a day are contacting a COVID-19 support line asking for help, and predicting that 40,000 to 50,000 Aucklanders may lose their jobs in the pandemic recession. With us is economist from Infometrics, Brad Olson. Brad, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
So is this a bit of an unexpected shock, these numbers?
Look, we were really surprised when we saw them. Essentially, what we've got, though, is that although the unemployment rate has fallen, what we've seen is that a number of people are still out of work. They just weren't able to find a new job. Now, definitionally, that means they're not unemployed, but we have seen an increase of 45,000 people onto the likes of the underutilization field. Now, what we're seeing here is that people are still in a real tough place. As well, if we look at the unemployment rate, Stats look sort of over each week, it did rise to around about 6% at the end of June. And overall, what we're seeing is that Kiwis are still in a tough place. The official numbers don't show it on the surface, but in total, we're seeing a very, very hard position for people that are working or trying to find a new job.
Right. So it's really the underemployment is as much of an issue as the unemployment.
Absolutely. Throughout the June quarter, we saw that the total number of hours worked was 10% lower than the same time last year. That's the largest drop in 30 years. So although people were still working, there were a lot of them working fewer hours. For people that were already in work, some of them did lose their jobs, but they weren't able to even find or attempt to find a new one. Overall, there is still a number of people that are doing it quite tough. That headline number doesn't reflect the entire reality yet. And we've got to remember there's 67,000 Kiwis since March 20 that have gone on to the wage subsidy, onto the benefit support, the job seeker support, or the CIRP. If you're an unemployed person out there, you're hearing these unemployment rate numbers coming out, they're not going to be believable. It doesn't change the fact that people have lost jobs.
Right. Yes. Okay. Interesting. Well, stay with us. Jen, let's bring you in. What are you seeing both in your area, Hawke's Bay, and also in your sector? Because you deal with some aspects of infrastructure. Some of those shovel-ready projects are by no means shovel-ready. People are being laid off.
Yeah, I think that's definitely been happening. I'm seeing a lot of that underemployment. As Brad mentioned, people that are wanting to work longer hours but are only sort of getting 25 hours a week instead of 40. So that's been really big. And I agree with him. I think this we're only getting a partial picture of the labour market impacts at the moment. So until the wage subsidy comes off and the benefits change towards the end of September, we're not really going to get a real feel for it. So I'd be really interested to see what happens in the next quarter, which I think will give us a more reflective picture of where things are actually at.
What's your view, Chris?
Oh, exactly the same. It's when the wage subsidies come off in September that's going to be where we're really going to see it, maybe even a quarter after that, maybe even going up to Christmas. That it's going to be, I think, really sad for us. My young children, well, they're not young, and they work in a printing industry, and they're going great guns in Auckland, but other areas outside of Auckland, they're not doing so well, so they're laying people off.
Okay.
So it's, I think part of it is, as Jenny's seeing, and the regions might be different.
Hey, Brad, what about unemployment data difference for younger and older workers? Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, certainly what we've seen through a number of the numbers in recent weeks and months is that young people are really bearing the brunt of this downturn. Mm-hmm. People over the age of 30, job numbers have started to come back. If you're under 30 like me, a lot of my friends, they are reporting it's very, very tough. A lot of them have lost jobs. A lot of them can't find anything new. So for young people, this recession, this economic downturn is hitting our youth really, really hard.
Gosh. That's interesting, isn't it? So what do we need to develop from now on? More policies because that can't go on, Brad.
No, it can't. And if young people are bearing the brunt of this, we're also rising debt at the moment. That's going to contribute more for young people as we move through, and we've got to pay it off. What I think we need to see is, continued work development, business development, because at the end of the day, we need jobs and we need businesses that are willing to supply them. So there is a real focus on getting businesses into a position that they're happy to take on people. At the same time, we need to get young people in a work-ready mode, and that might be for a different job than they might have originally envisaged. And so I think we need to be realistic that people might not get the job they want, but for the next few years, I think people will be happy enough to settle for a job they can get.
Okay. Yeah. Brad Olson, thank you very much for being with us on that. So some interesting statistics coming through. These numbers here not reflecting really the reality of what's on the ground, Jenny. It's no other way to describe it. It's very disheartening and quite tragic when you... I mean, I've got a colleague, a friend rather, who is going into a meeting this week to probably discuss, you know, being laid off after doing his full apprenticeship. It is so tough, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really tough. And I've got children who have got friends that, you know, they're out from university and they've had maybe 6 months' experience and they're now laid off, and that's really tough and disheartening for them. And I think, you know, to Brad's point, kind of, I guess, managing expectations around getting these kids to be sort of re-engaged to do some sort of work, even if it's not what they necessarily see as their ideal job. But, you know, it's really tough for them. They've got high student loans and, you know, they're desperate to get out into the workforce.
Yeah. 17 past four. By the way, keep those transport questions coming for the panel tomorrow, Transport Special. Here's a great one from Andrew. Why do Auckland Transport buses not have bike racks? These have been a part of the Vancouver transport network for over 20 years. Why can't we have them here? I think it's quite a good one.
They have them in Christchurch.
Do they?
Yep. Bike racks on the buses in Christchurch, but not here.
You sure?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
I work in, that's part of the industry that work in. And, you know, when I was a kid, they used to have prams on the front and back.
Yes, true.
Remember that?
I do.
Yeah.
All right, the panel at rnz.co.nz, your transport questions. But to Australia, and an item in The Age, in what Victoria can learn from New Zealand's drastic lockdown. And one psychologist highlighted the stress that young children will be under, as well as the parents, and thought it might be a good idea to have some public messaging aimed at children. A press conference for children, says one Australian psychologist, would help alleviate their anxiety. Meanwhile, Victoria had another 725 new coronavirus cases today, 15 deaths in Victoria's worst day yet. Non-essential retail stores in Melbourne will shut at 11:59pm tonight. Dr. Christine Grove is a developmental psychologist and senior lecturer at Monash University. Dr. Grove, welcome to the panel.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It was very interesting, your piece in The Age, or in which you mentioned, but it, needless to say, extremely hard time for children and parents having to go back into quite a strict lockdown. A lot of people here could really relate to that.
Absolutely. It has been really tough, and it's come quite quickly over a period of a few days too. So quite a few parents and families don't know how to talk about COVID at home and the new restrictions that have come in. I mean, we're seeing a lot more questions from children too, being uncertain about what's happening. And often we know from research that they fill in the gaps too. So they actually become more worried, or they feel more scared what could come because they're not sure about what's happening. So that's why it was so fantastic to see New Zealand host a press conference for children and families to model how to talk about COVID-19 in a way that is safe and comfortable for kids to learn about it.
So, yeah, you had a bit of a focus on that, and we did have that. What was that Prime Minister stand-up where she said, "So I say to the children of New Zealand, if the Easter Bunny doesn't make it to your household, we understand it's a bit tough," and then went on to maybe draw an Easter egg or put a bunny in the window, and I certainly, my little toddler, actually, it made the time pass going around the neighbourhood. But you were saying that type of communication doesn't yet happen in Victoria?
At the moment, we haven't seen it, you know, on the level where we might be directly talking to children and young people. And so it's fantastic to see leaders around the world just stepping up and stepping forward and prioritising the information needs of children and young people. I mean, it's so easy to forget that they do need different information to what we might see adults receive at these conferences. So they have important questions to ask, and they do want to listen and help our community too. It's easy to forget that they are part of our pandemic response team, as active members of the community too during COVID-19. So I do think we can step in and together to help Victoria answer some of these questions around children's needs about the COVID-19 and how to help as well.
And also the parents too, Christine. There was an interesting opinion piece in The Guardian from parents saying first time around fine, but second time around she's actually mentally not prepared for it. She was saying every time I put my son in front of a screen so I can take that work call or breastfeed a sister to sleep, empty the dishwasher, put in the online order for a shopping, the guilt ties itself around my heart like a tourniquet. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be hard for parents.
Oh, absolutely. You know, for parents, it is new challenges we've never, ever seen or experienced before. And I think families are trying the best they can in these situations. And we really need to share messages of hope around. We need to change our expectations of what we can do right now. And if that iPad's coming out so you can do that Zoom meeting with work, that's absolutely reasonable. And those families aren't alone in managing and responding like that in this pandemic. All right. So really reach out to families in that situation. And you're not alone. A lot of parents are experiencing that too.
Good to have you on, Dr. Christine Grove, psychologist at Monash University. Tough time for Victoria right now, Jenny Giblin.
Yeah, it's pretty tough, all right. And I think, you know, what the New Zealand government did so well here was that they had really easy, clear and consistent messaging.
Yep.
And so that messaging was, I think, really easy for children to understand as well. Because, you know, it's easy to sort of, as an adult, get into your own world and think about how you're impacted. But it had a huge impact here in New Zealand on our children. And I was really conscious of that because I've got a lot of them. Mm. And how important it is to actually get down to their level and make sure that they feel supported and that they, because there's a lot of anxiety for kids. You know, they're away from their friends, they're away from sport. And then how they reintegrate back in afterwards was also, you know, quite tough for them.
Chris?
Yeah, I think the Australian government made a fundamental error that we didn't. They just said, we'll manage it. We'll look after people when they get sick, as opposed to us here saying, we're going to get rid of this. But I do agree with Jenny. The messaging was very simple. You know, look after yourself, take care of all that sort of thing came through at the end of, and we all listened, didn't we, at 1 o'clock every day, listened to Dr. Ashley Bloomfield and the Prime Minister. The message was, as Jenny says, very simple, very crisp, very clear, and it was consistent. It just stayed every day. So it was easy to pick up on.
Yeah, and I think kids could have understood it really well because we talked about being a team of 5 million, so there was kind of that sense of being united together, which was really good, and probably we united as a country like we haven't before.
Yeah.
And that kind of stay home, stay safe, it's all pretty simple stuff. And so people could have caught on to that across all ages, I guess.
Oh, it was just brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
And talking to my sister who lives in Melbourne and a cousin over there, they said, why didn't we do what you guys did? They can't get over it.
24 past four. Meanwhile, bike racks exploding on Twitter. Sorry, not Twitter, the text machine. And it seems like Auckland might just be an outlier in not having bike racks on buses. They have bike racks on buses in Hawke's Bay. In Tauranga, bike racks on buses in Wellington too, says George. Bike racks on buses in Whangarei, Christchurch. Well, why doesn't Auckland have... That'd be amazing to have bike racks on buses. We'll discuss that tomorrow. But true this, and this is an Auckland issue, to central Auckland now, where two restaurants are facing claims of cultural appropriation. The Herald reports that Coco's Cantina, a very well-known restaurant on K Road Eatery, is considering a name change after critics said that they are appropriating Latin culture. That comes after the owners of new seafood restaurant Kingi were accused of Māori cultural appropriation by the founders of Coco's Cantina. So all a bit confusing there, but we asked just where is the line when it comes to this? Professor of Māori Studies at Auckland University of Technology, Dr. Ella Henry, is with us now. Dr. Henry, Tanakwe, welcome to the program.
Kia ora, Wallace. Kia ora, always everyone.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this one, isn't it? What's your take on this issue,
well,
if you like?
If nothing else, both restaurants are getting fabulous free commercials, so that's got to be a plus. And also, the Kingi restaurant, I've looked to see how it's been spelled, because the Māori word Kingi has a macron over the I. So unless they've spelled the restaurant with a macron over the I, then it's theoretically not a Māori word. And Kingi, the Māori word, is actually a transliteration of an English word. So perhaps we could be accused of cultural appropriation for taking the word from the British Crown. But I do think this has become an odd conversation. And I do understand that one of the owners of Coco's Cantina is Māori and has her own view, which I absolutely respect. Mm. But their cafe is, if I understand it, Spanish, and roughly half a billion people on the planet speak Spanish. So it's very hard to call the using of a Spanish word or words cultural appropriation.
Right.
The language shares so many people. But also, I mean, if we're going to start down that track, what are we going to do with mozzarella?
and isn't the word cafe, isn't it from a French derivation?
Cafe,
Isn't that French derivation? Have we nicked that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we? I was going to say, sorry, Ella.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, you keep going.
I do think that this is an interesting situation. And one thing I did notice about the Tangi restaurant owners is they had actually brought in a well-known Māori artist as a cultural advisor. So obviously they're doing other design things to, you know, to show that it's a very New Zealand-centric cafe restaurant. And I applaud people using the Māori language if they do it with integrity and they honour the language and the word and its meaning and engage cultural advisors. So that I find very laudable.
Interesting, isn't it? Hey, Dr. Henry, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. What do you think, Jenny, about this? Because when it comes to the culture of food, the nature of food, there's a lot of, whether it be homage or appropriation, borrowing, stealing,
know. No, my view is the English language is full of words that we've borrowed from other languages. So, I mean, I just sort of think that this is probably a bit of an overreach.
Chris? Yeah, it's gone a wee bit too far. Where do you draw the line? And there's a great cafe, if I'm allowed to use that word, tea rooms, there you go.
So why don't we be honest?
Tea rooms. Isn't,
why don't we, yeah. We're from Aotearoa, why don't we say tea rooms or
well, that's what we
or
used
an
to
equivalent?
Say, but we changed it to a coffee room now. And the tea rooms I was thinking of is the one in the row between Christchurch and Littleton, the sign of the Takahe.
Yes.
That tea room's
I
up
I know
there.
The place.
You know the place?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a tea room.
And that was called a tea room?
Yeah, it was. It was called a tea room. And we had lots of tea rooms in Dunedin when I was a lad. Now they have lots of places you go and drink coffee, not tea.
And it changed from, what, a coffee house to a cafe, did it?
Mm. Yeah.
Why, do you think we should just go back to our roots, Jenny, and say, for example, if you're going to set up a place in Hawke's Bay, just call it Jenny's Kitchen?
Oh, God. I don't know. I just think this is a bit of an overreaction, and we fall into this really sort of PC thinking around and overthink this sort of stuff. I mean, we do need to be cognizant around being culturally appropriate, but then sometimes I think we cross the line and it becomes ridiculous.
Or is it progress? We've got to start, at last, Jenny, we've got to start thinking about these issues where we were never asked to prior.
Mm. Now, are you allowed to use a restaurant now? Because restaurants, you know, that's again, it's somebody else's word, isn't it? Restaurant.
Mm. Yeah. It becomes a bit ridiculous, I think.
Yeah, it does,
okay.
Isn't it?
Be interesting to hear what you think of that. Yeah. It is coming up to 4:30. Regarding the story of the day with Amelia Langford, kia ora Wallace, same but different. St. Jacob's Church in Prague, a jewel of a destination for Sunday morning mass. The organ playing ranges between the most high-pitched, delicate notes to body-vibrating, thunderous tones. Ooh. And after Mass, the priest and the choir boys parade out, singing. Such a magnificent event. And then, picture this, an American tourist walked in, backwards, in front of them, all the way down the aisle, until he backs into the christening font and knocks it off the pedestal.
Oh,
God.
Goodness me.
All right. Jenny Giblin and Chris Saw on the program this afternoon. We discuss the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill, which the government will push through under urgency before it rises this year. And a study on the health and well-being of New Zealanders have found that our rangatahi are lonelier and feeling less connected compared to other age groups. All that and more on the panel